There's an ambivalence that we carry about progress, technological change. It's all reflected in our love of gadgets, but also this nostalgia that we have about something like 8-track tapes. I mean, where'd they go? My iPod is great, but remember movie theaters? Love my phone, but whatever happened to talking face-to-face and making eye contact? I remember eye contact. Kindle is great. Hey, but I still love those paper things with the words in them. Remember those books? One listener is not nostalgic about his own old name.
My handle on the internet is Tinian, and this has been a long-running thing since the early days of internet relay chat. My real name is Brett, but I don't tend to use it online as such because Tinian's more well-known now. It's sort of become part of me.
Don't call him Brett, one of many listeners who responded to our anchor question asking if their online names were different than their real ones. Virginia Heffernan went by a username Athena as a 9-year-old, and in the early 1970s, she was an internet user with a name fitting for someone who views the internet not as some sort of top-down business or engineering endeavor, but as one of the purest forms of human expression and culture. She's a New York Times Magazine contributor and author of the new book Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art. It's a fascinating read. Heffernan says the internet is perhaps the greatest experiment in human interaction in world history.
We tell the story of the internet as an engineering project and a business proposition and an extension of a military project. But as far as I can tell, there's always been a kind of digital culture, avatar creation, even around the infrastructure that ends up making something like Gmail possible. I sort of think of it as, you know, how you never find bones of man without bones of a dog next to it, that like men and dogs have always gone together. Pretty early on, coders in the, you know, in the 60s started using avatars, making jokes, creating ASCII art.
That's the symbol art, like the emoticons.
Yeah, the little shrug. You know, by this strange chance of early computing, when I was a child in 1979, I asked my parents for a so-called dumb terminal so I could dial in with a phone on a modem. Very satisfying, that eek of information. Yeah. I'd never heard it before.
You can do it really well.
Thank you.
We had one of those in high school.
Yeah.
One of those PDP-11 terminals.
Totally.
We used to play Gunner on it.
Yes.
It was all very mathematical.
Okay, you just said exactly what I mean, which is you get a computer and your first thought, the first thought of a lot of us is, how can I make this a game? And if it's a network, how can I make this social? So now on Twitter, I go by Page 88. But then in 1979, I was naturally Athena. I wanted to talk to pals. I was 10, so I also wanted to talk to people and pretend to be older about things like Reaganomics that I knew nothing about, but I could pose. And I wanted to play a version of a Gunner-style game, you know, that was on those phosphor screens that, you know, from war games, mm-hmm. total deep black background. I just poured my love into that background.
And at that time, you were a fringe character in society, and now you're mainstream. I mean, and when did that table turn?
I went on parallel tracks. So I swore off the internet on the grounds that it was like for desperate, lonely hearts. I went into the humanities, which I thought was much more feminine and good and not geeky. But all the while, I was drawn to the Center for Internet and Society. And I went over there and started to listen to these lawyers talk about how they were going to govern cyberspace as if it was the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the only people in charge of it would be these Harvard gods. And at that point, on some level, I resolved to bring the methodologies of the humanities to this new technology.
A lot of people who criticize the internet say that it suppresses sensory reality, that it diminishes our engagement with the world because it's a step back. It's virtual, not real.
Yeah.
You say that the internet has reached a point where that's really no longer the case, that it is such a vibrant living being on its own that it much more directly maps the real world rather than diminishes it.
A lot of people describe civilization as a move to greater and greater symbolism. So, you know, in finance, we go from like gold chunks to gold ingots to ultimately to Bitcoin to, derivatives, right? Increasing abstraction. So if you like abstraction, online is not an affront. You're living in a new symbolic order, growing at an incredible speed and seeing language made in front of you is appealing to a lot of us who are drawn to literature, drawn to finance, drawn to, you know, even science and mathematics. But the material world always pushes back on that. We love live concerts. we suddenly want vinyl, that groove, that actual three-dimensional groove.
And in fact, the growth of the internet created the high value of live concert experiences.
Absolutely.
So it essentially reinforced the material world.
Yeah. I mean, we could easily be dialing in, you know, with our polycoms to hear all this stuff, and yet we want to see each other in person. I'm delighted to be able to see you in person today, John.
I mean, I have to say, quite frankly, as a parent, it's hard to evaluate what's positive and what's negative about the internet when you see the way kids are just absorbed and addicted, and you sometimes just can't reach them.
Yeah.
And you just don't know what to make of it. And you can aesthetics and, you know, Heffernan your all day long, and you still feel a little bit nervous.
I think that's probably part of parenting, that your kids create an, you know, opaque idiom that only they understand. My mother would look at that deep black phosphor screen that I would look at and say, "What are you doing?" The way I look at my children, the Minecraft screen, and it literally is illegible to me. I have no idea what it says.
Yeah.
But one thing I think about when you think about youth culture generally, I just saw, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but Jimmy Page, you know, the guitarist, the first ever performance of his as a child, you know, maybe an early teenager, he's playing skiffle music, and he's playing a song called Mama, it goes, "Mama don't want no skiffle music around here. No, she don't." And I mean, it is the simplest, sweetest song. And the host comes out and says, "You know, why do you all make this racket? What do you want in the world?" And one of them says, "Well, I made my stand-up bass." Jimmy Page says, "I want to be a doctor and cure cancer." And all this host can see is that they're doing something derelict and truant by playing this, like, totally innocuous skiffle music. The whole idea that, like, your mama finds skiffle music deafening and horrible and terrible is part of the tension I'm describing. So you look
it's a good thing.
Yeah.
We want our children to find worlds of their own.
We want them to, you know, fall in the margins of what we think is respectable and even, you know, visible, and, you know, and make something new. And it's astounding how much they are making something new.
Well, Virginia Heffernan, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Virginia Heffernan is the author of the book Magic and Loss, The Internet as Art.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.